Maybe you've seen the pictures of crowds on the Ocean City Boardwalk or at the Lake of the Ozarks in the middle of a pandemic. As much as people may want business as usual, we've got a long way to go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From a home studio in Baltimore today, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, May 25th. Good to have you with us on this Memorial Day. The gradual reopening is happening, whether we're ready or not, even as the number of Americans who've died from COVID-19 approaches 100,000. More states are relaxing stay-at-home orders and allowing more businesses to reopen. But exactly when and how and which ones varies place to place. And as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, the patchwork of rules can be confusing.
Like a lot of salons, Bespoke Hair Studio in Washington, D.C. makes money from more than just haircuts and coloring. Samantha Banks is the owner.
I have a glass door, like a big picture window, and you can see my beautiful display of products.
And Banks says she thought she could possibly do curbside pickups for those products, even though she can't give haircuts. But Banks never tried to find out. She thinks it's too early, and she doesn't want it to look like she's cutting hair and not following the rules. Elizabeth Melito at the National Federation of Independent Business says business owners have been flooding her phone with questions about the rules as different states, and sometimes different counties within those states, operate in different stages.
It's kind of all over the place. So the reopening orders inevitably result in relief, excitement, confusion, and then for some business owners, disappointment.
Kylie North says she experienced all those feelings recently. She and her wife own Water Bear Bar, a cocktail lounge in Boise, Idaho. Stage 2 of Idaho's reopening includes in-restaurant dining. She thought, we have food. Grilled cheese, baked oysters, potato skins. Maybe we count.
We quickly were reminded, no, we don't.
The business is licensed as a bar. And in Idaho, 40% of sales must come from food to be considered a restaurant. Water Bear clocks in at 25%. And though it's hard to watch other businesses on her street reopen their doors, she says she gets it. Bars are not restaurants. She says she wants her bar to be a place where people can mingle.
So much of going to a bar is being more fluid. Like, we could meet the right one. Like, they could be just sitting right next to me.
Or eventually, maybe more like 6 feet away. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Even before this crisis, roughly 500,000 Americans were homeless, a number likely to get worse as millions of people who've lost their jobs and income struggle to pay for housing. An initiative in California called Project Room Key aims to convert 15,000 vacant hotel rooms into temporary housing for the homeless. Kara Carnahan is the director of programs for Abode Services. The nonprofit agency has moved nearly 400 people into two hotels in the Bay Area. I spoke with Kara back in early April when they were just getting started, so we thought we'd check back in today. Kara, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Amy.
So when we last spoke, Project Room Key was just getting off the ground. You were in the middle of moving folks in. Things are a little hectic. Have you settled in now?
We have settled in. We're almost fully staffed. We've been able to, you know, touch everybody in the program, assess them, figure out what their needs are, and we're starting to work on plans for them. And we've even had a few people transition out to other places because they've gotten housing already. So that's been exciting as well.
Just set the scene for me. What kind of space are you in? What does it look like? How is it different from a typical homeless shelter?
So we are right now, I'm at the Radisson Hotel in Oakland near the Oakland Airport. The lobby is where a lot of our action happens. It's where people get meals. It's where they meet with their case managers. It's where we have shelter monitors that can provide them with clothing, hygiene supplies, dog food. We have about 50 pets here.
Wow.
Yeah, we do cats and dogs. And then we have different groups that come through as well to provide throughout the week to provide different resources to our residents. And then we go into the grand ballroom, and that's where I spend a lot of my time because that's really where we're sort of figuring out what folks need, helping them to develop goals for themselves, and then really working to connect them to the various resources that they need to achieve those goals.
In this program statewide, it's been reported that only about half the 15,000 rooms have been filled. What do you think are the big challenges of actually getting people housed in these vacant hotels?
We are not having a challenge at all. We targeted our shelters within Alameda County that were the most crowded and less able to social distance residents within their sleeping facilities. And so we took 175 households out of those shelters. Some came out of encampments as well. So we really are at full capacity and have about 15 people that are waiting for those couple of empty rooms that we have.
Well, I don't want to ask you to speak for other communities, but do you think that you've got what advantages do you have, you know, in Oakland or Alameda County that maybe some other cities don't in trying to get people housed?
Yeah, it's really surprising that you would think that just offering somebody a hotel room that they would jump at the chance and, you know, get right over here the first day that you offer it to them. Sometimes we have to offer it numerous times. I think when a new resource comes out too, the homeless community has had sort of bad experiences with the system per se that, you know, until word gets out that this is a safe place for them to be, that sometimes it's not a resource that's heavily utilized. And I think that enough people have come through here or they know other people that are living here that I think it's gotten a good reputation that people want to be here. People don't want to leave.
How has this crisis been for you personally? I imagine you're working pretty long hours.
I am working really long hours. I'm a single mom, so, you know, I have a great provider that takes care of my son. Thank goodness I wouldn't be able to do this without her. And my son has noticed that I work really long hours. So we've had to have some conversations about why I'm doing this and why it's so important for me to do this, sort of to invite him in as like, you know, we're doing this together to really support people that really need us right now that might otherwise not do well on the streets if we weren't here to do this.
Kara Carnahan, Director of Programs for Abode Services. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, markets were closed for the holiday. We'll have an update on the global markets when we do the numbers. It's not just small businesses grappling with how to reopen. A lot of graduating high school seniors are wondering what college is going to look like come fall and whether, like so much else these days, their first classes will happen online. That uncertainty and the state of the economy have some recent grads rethinking their college plans. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Like a lot of 18-year-olds, Anna Para Jordan can't wait to move out of her parents' house. Go to college, move into a dorm, make new friends.
Have my space and be independent.
But now she's not planning to do any of that. Not this fall, anyway.
I'm not going to pay all that money to maybe end up doing courses online and, you know, not being in a class setting.
She had been planning to go to the University of Pittsburgh, which, like most colleges, is saying it hopes to reopen in the fall. But she's just not willing to take the risk of possibly starting college from her bedroom at her parents' house.
Like, absolutely not. I refuse. If I can prevent that from happening, I'm going to.
So she's taking a gap year and hoping to get a job or an internship, maybe even travel when things start to open up. One in six students who had planned to go to college full-time in the fall have decided not to, according to a recent study from education consultants Art and Science Group. Others are thinking differently about where they want to go, mostly for financial reasons.
It's less about, am I going to college, but it's comparing colleges and saying, what's the return?
Jeff Fuller is director of college counseling at Strake Jesuit College Preparatory, a boys' high school in Houston. And he's seeing a lot of students decide to stay closer to home this year or go to state schools instead of private ones.
Students or families looking at it from the lens of, should I pay $40,000 or more for this education when there's a school that's offering me a just as good education, but a fraction of the cost?
That is exactly what Sage Segura was trying to figure out. Whether it was worth it to go to his first choice school, Loyola Marymount in LA, or whether he should go to the University of California, Riverside, for about $15,000 less a year.
I was kind of freaking out about this whole thing.
Because of the money. His grandmother, who's raising him, is a hairdresser, and she hasn't been able to work since March.
This is making it a little bit harder for us to figure out how we're going to pay first year's tuition and things like that.
Going to UC Riverside would be a lot cheaper.
But my grandma and I were having this talk about I lost like the most important months of senior year.
And she did not want him to lose out on going to his first choice college, too.
She wants it for me just as bad as I do.
So after agonizing until the last possible minute, he finally decided to just go for it. Go to Loyola Marymount, find a way to make it work. He's asking the school for more money, since his grandmother's income has changed. And he figures,
it would almost be like a little bit of a blessing in disguise if they were to just lower the cost and it's online through fall semester.
Two-thirds of students say they'd expect to pay less if classes are entirely online, according to that Art and Science Group study. But even that wouldn't be enough to make Anna Para Jordan want to start college remotely.
I would really rather not have my freshman year end up like my senior year did.
It's just been hard, she says, to miss out on so many things she'd been looking forward to, like prom and graduation, and starting college. But that, at least, she will get to do eventually.
I know I will go to college. Like, I will go at some point.
And she's confident that some point will be next year. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
For more on COVID-19, Marketplace has launched a 10-minute daily Make Me Smart with Kai Rizdahl and Molly Wood to help make today make sense. Subscribe to the Make Me Smart feed wherever you get your podcasts. Staying on the theme of reopening, restaurants and coffee shops are trying to figure out how to stay in business when so many of us are eating at home. For some, takeout was already at least part of their business model, but for others, it's totally new. Kate Ashwell runs a vintage clothing store and cafe in Bristol, England. Her husband, Will, bakes the cakes they serve.
We are quite a quirky business. We sell vintage clothing and we also host afternoon teas and afternoon tea parties.
And we've changed from doing everything in-house to doing everything outside. So basically sending our afternoon teas to people's doors.
And we've had all sorts, from people who, are, of course, are having special birthdays to people who were meant to be getting married. So we are actually turning over more than we did before lockdown. I think we will continue to do the deliveries as long as is possible, basically until the government says, yep, it's fine. You don't have to socially distance anymore.
This is the problem that the whole hospitality industry is going to have just after, you know, now after lockdown is actually the most unstable point for our industry, isn't it?
There's a lot of wait and see, isn't there, at the moment?
I think that's the realisation that everyone's sort of starting to accept that this is going to be a much, much longer term thing. It seems to be very unknown.
If we are in a situation where we are sort of neither open nor shut, and we can only let a small amount of people into the space at a time, we can't make a living of having 6 to 8 people having afternoon tea on a Saturday.
We're sort of going to sort of see how it goes and just keep aware of what's going on and do the right thing.
That was Kate and Will Ashwell at Heartfelt Vintage in Bristol, England, courtesy of our friends at the BBC. You can tell us about your personal economy at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Soap was discovered approximately 4,500 years ago in ancient Mesopotamia.
And it wasn't used for hand washing. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed for the Memorial Day holiday, so we turn to overseas markets. In Europe, it was a mixed picture. Britain's FTSE fell 0.3%. France's CAC 40 boosted 2.1%. And Germany's DAX was up 2.8%. The New York Stock Exchange plans to reopen its physical trading floor tomorrow with a whole bunch of new safety measures. Think masks and lots of plexiglass. If you missed Friday's show, Kai talked to Stacy Cunningham, president of the NYSE. You can hear that at marketplace.org or download the podcast. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. It's the time of year when snowbirds, people who spend their winters in warmer southern states, start migrating back to the north in search of cooler weather. And this year, COVID-19 is complicating that migration. Local officials are caught trying to find a balance between protecting their communities from the disease as people return from places that may have more infections and protecting the economies that depend on people flocking north for the summer. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker has that story.
For the past 3 years, Robin Arger and her husband Jeff have spent winters in the little town of Madrid, New Mexico. Jeff has MS, and they wanted a warmer, drier place to live for a few months. Then in spring, they head to their home on Owen Lake in Minnesota, 4 hours north of the Twin Cities. They usually head back in April, but as states began to put stay-at-home orders in place in March, the Argers worried they might not be able to return home to Minnesota.
One morning, we just got up and decided we got to go. Threw everything in the back of the truck and off we went, you know.
There weren't a lot of cars on the highway.
But most of the cars that we traveled with or that passed us were all Minnesotans coming home. And we laughed. Everybody was waving and honking their horns. Everybody was making the pilgrimage back, you know, at that time to get tucked in.
The state of Minnesota estimates that more than 44,000 Minnesotans spend their winters elsewhere. Some, like the Argers, have already come back. Others are delaying their returns. They're weighing the risks of travel and what they're hearing from the communities they want to return to. Carol Steele lives outside Grand Rapids, Minnesota, near the Argers' place. She worries when she sees people who returned from out of town.
Then I wonder, where did they come from? Did they come back already from someplace that isn't taking care with regulations to keep people safe?
It's a tough balancing act for a lot of rural communities that want to protect locals from the coronavirus while still welcoming the snowbirds and cabin owners and tourists who drive the summertime economy. Ben DiNucci is a county commissioner who also runs a small grocery store.
We want everyone to be safe. We want everyone to follow the guidelines. But at the same time, we know if we don't have this traffic, it's going to be really difficult.
The solution DiNucci's county came up with was to ask all returning snowbirds to self-quarantine for 2 weeks. Some counties in the area took a more aggressive tack earlier in the spring. They asked snowbirds and tourists to stay away for a while. But Cook County Commissioner Heidi Dukirk says that didn't sit well with some.
I got emails with people itemizing the amount of money they spend here and how they support the community.
Now Dukirk's county has softened its approach.
We're not saying you're not welcome here. You are absolutely welcome here. We're saying when you get here, self-quarantine for at least 14 days. Come with everything that you need and prepared to stay in your home.
That's what Robin Arger says she and her husband did when they returned from New Mexico. And they're still not going out much.
You know, we have kind of hunkered down and stand put until this thing gets better.
And she makes a distinction between snowbirds and vacationers. This is her home, she says. She has family and friends here. It's the best place, she says, to ride out a global pandemic. I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
As you know, this holiday weekend is the unofficial kickoff to summer, and usually that means garage sales, also known as, depending where you're from, yard, tag, or stoop sales. And boy, was I looking forward to purging the basement this year. But as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, the reuse economy could look a lot different in the age of social distancing.
For Renee Translator of Pittsburgh, pretty much every summer weekend is spent scouring yard sales for toys and figurines. But this year?
I think now, because of the COVID-19, I think that yard sales are a little bit too close for comfort. If you stop at a yard sale, there's always going to be other people there, and I don't feel comfortable handling items that other people are handling.
As some states reopen, health departments are coming up with guidelines for these sales to prevent the spread of COVID-19. In Vermont, no more than 10 people at a sale. In Ohio, making sure all merchandise is washed and dried and/or wiped down with a disinfectant, that hand sanitizer is available, and that tables and chairs are set 6 feet apart. Kat Holmes, who lives outside Cleveland, had a 3-day yard sale that ended Saturday. She wore a mask and gloves and...
We put arrows on the floor. Like, start here, and it actually worked out where when we snaked people around, they started in, and then they exited out at the last row.
Her profit? Around $500. Donna Tauber of Indiana helps organize the National Historic Road Yard Sale, where hundreds of vendors along U.S. 40 sell from Baltimore to St. Louis. Because unemployment is so high...
We know that people are going to want to make some extra fast cash by having a sale, so there may be more sales...
The event is usually held this week, but it's been postponed. Organizers may try to hold it in August. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
It's no surprise that sales of soap are way up, as this crisis has all of us, I hope anyway, washing our hands a lot more, maybe while we sing our ABCs. But when soap was first created thousands of years ago, it wasn't used to clean people at all. Cody Cassidy tells the story behind the invention of soap in his new book, Who Ate the First Oyster? The Extraordinary People Behind the Greatest Firsts in History. The extraordinary person behind soap? Cassidy calls her Nini.
Soap was discovered approximately 4,500 years ago in ancient Mesopotamia. This is when the first evidence that soap was made comes up. And it comes up in relation to wool making, which was sort of the primary export of these cities in ancient Mesopotamia. And they were sort of a scale that's kind of hard to imagine for how long ago it was. Thousands of people were involved in plucking these sheep and weaving the wool. And most of the weavers were women. And so I propose that Nini may have been a woman. And Nini is short for Nini Sina, who was the goddess of medicine. Nini worked in a textile manufacturing plant, processing wool, and she made soap as a way to remove the lanolin from the wool, which allowed them to dye it. When Nini created it, soap was certainly not used to clean people, and almost certainly only used to clean things such as wool, maybe dishes, but not people, and certainly not hands. Because the dangerous bacterias and viruses that soap destroys and removes are invisible, Nini nor the Mesopotamians had any idea what she had invented. It may have, in the end, she may have succumbed to the bacteria that she invented the cure for. Soap might seem very simple, and it is simple to make, but it might represent the greatest medical discovery ever. It's probably saved more lives than penicillin. The number of lives it saved is uncountable, but it's certainly high. And in fact, the WHO says sort of increased soap use could save more than 1 million lives per year today.
Now, Now this final note, in which a friendly bet between colleagues gets settled. The average price of a gallon of gas in this country, according to AAA, is $1.96 today. That's the lowest price for a Memorial Day in 17 years. But not low enough for me to win said bet with Marketplace's Scott Tong. A couple months back, as oil prices were plunging amid falling global demand and a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, we wondered where prices would be on Memorial Day. That's, of course, the start of the summer road trip season in a normal year. Scott guessed $1.99. I went with $1.89, which would have been spot on just a week ago. Prices have been rising as states ease restrictions. As for the wager, I have to do Scott's job for a day, management permitting. He was closer by 4 lousy cents. That's it for me. We got to go. Markets were closed today for the Memorial Day holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. And I'm Amy Scott. Have a good rest of your Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.